Chapter 10. The Oregon Trail. The War Parties. The summer of 1846 was a season of much warlike excitement among all the western bands of the Dakotai. In 1845 they encountered great reverses. Many war parties had been sent out, some of them had been totally cut off, and others had returned broken and disheartened, so that the whole nation was in mourning. Among the rest, 10 warriors had gone to the Snake Country, led by the son of a prominent Ojolali chief, called the Whirlwind. In passing over Laramie Plains they encountered a superior number of their enemies, were surrounded, and killed to a man. Having performed this exploit, the Snakes became alarmed, dreading the resentment of the Dakotai, and they listened therefore to signify their wish for peace by sending the scalp of the slain partisan, together with a small parcel of tobacco attached, to his tribesmen and relations. They had employed old Vasquez, the trader, as their messenger, and the scalp was the same that hung in our room at the fort. But the Whirlwind proved inexorable. Though his character hardly corresponds with his name, he is nevertheless an Indian, and hates the Snakes with his whole soul. Long before the scalp arrived, he had made his preparations for revenge. He sent messengers with presents and tobacco to all the Dakotai within 300 miles, proposing a grand combination to chastise the Snakes, and naming a place and time of rendezvous. The plan was readily adopted, and at this moment many villages, probably embracing in the whole 5,000 or 6,000 souls, were slowly creeping over the prairies and tending toward the common center at La Bonne's camp, in the Platte. Here their warlike rites were to be celebrated with more than ordinary solemnity, and 1,000 warriors, as it was said, were to set out for the enemy's country. The characteristic result of this preparation will appear in the sequel. I was greatly rejoiced to hear of it. I had come into the country almost exclusively with a view of observing the Indian character. Having from childhood felt a curiosity in this subject, and having failed completely to gratify it by reading, I resolved to have recourse to observation. I wished to satisfy myself with regard to the position of the Indians among the races of men, the vices and the virtues that have sprung from their innate character and from their modes of life, their government, their superstitions, and their domestic situation. To accomplish my purpose it was necessary to live in the midst of them, and become, as it were, one of them. I proposed to join a village, and make myself an inmate of one of their lodges, and henceforward this narrative, so far as I am concerned, will be chiefly a record of the progress of this design, apparently so easy of accomplishment, and the unexpected impediments that opposed it. We resolved in no account to miss the rendezvous at La Bonne's camp. Our plan was to leave Delorier at the fort, in charge of our equipage and the better part of our horses, while we took with us nothing but our weapons and the worst animals we had. In all probability jealousies and quarrels would arise among so many hordes of fierce impulsive savages, congregated together under no common head, and many of them strangers, from remote prairies and mountains. We were bound in common prudence to be cautious, how we excited any feeling of cupidity. This was our plan, but unhappily we were not destined to visit La Bonne's camp in this manner, for one morning a young Indian came to the fort and brought us evil tidings. The newcomer was a dandy of the first water. His ugly face was painted with vermilion, in his head fluttered the tail of a prairie cock, a large species of pheasant, not found, as I have heard, eastward of the Rocky Mountains. Winking smiley face, in his ears were hung pendants of shell, and a flaming red blanket was wrapped around him. He carried a dragoon sword in his hand, solely for display, since the knife, the arrow, and the rifle are the arbiters of every prairie fight. But as no one in this country goes abroad unarmed, the dandy carried a bow and arrows in an otterskin quiver at his back. In this guise, and bestriding his yellow horse with an air of extreme dignity, the horse, for that was his name, rode in at the gate, turning neither to the right nor the left, but casting glances askance at the groups of squaws who, with their mongrel progeny, were sitting in the sun before their doors. The evil tidings brought by the horse were of the following import. The squaw of Henry Chatillon, a woman with whom he had been connected for years by the strongest ties which in that country exist between the sexes, was dangerously ill. She and her children were in the village of the Whirlwind, at the distance of a few days' journey. Henry was anxious to see the woman before she died, and provide for the safety and support of his children, of whom he was extremely fond. To have refused him this would have been gross inhumanity. We abandoned our plan of joining Smoke's village, and of proceeding with it to the rendezvous, and determined to meet the Whirlwind, and go in his company. I had been slightly ill for several weeks, but on the third night after reaching Fort Laramie a violent pain awoke me, and I found myself attacked by the same disorder that occasioned such heavy losses to the army on the Rio Grande. In a day and a half I was reduced to extreme weakness, so that I could not walk without pain and effort. Having within that time taken 6 grains of opium, without the least beneficial effect, and having no medical adviser, nor any choice of diet, I resolved to throw myself upon Providence for recovery, using, without regard to the disorder, any portion of strength that might remain to me. So on the 20th of June we set out from Fort Laramie to meet the Whirlwind's village. Aided by the high-boat mount and saddle, I could scarcely keep my seat on horseback. Before we left the fort we hired another man, a long-haired Canadian, with a face like an owl's, contrasting oddly enough with Delorier's mercurial countenance. This was not the only reinforcement to our party. A vagrant Indian trader, named Reno, joined us, together with his squaw Margaret, and her 2 nephews, our dandy friend, the horse, and his younger brother, the hailstorm. Us accompanied, we betook ourselves to the prairie, leaving the beaten trail, and passing over the desolate hills that flank the bottoms of Laramie Creek. In all, Indians and whites, we counted 8 men and 1 woman. Reno, the trader, the image of sleek and selfish complacency, carried the horse quote-unquote dragoon sword in his hand, delighting apparently in this useless parade, for, from spending half his life among Indians, he had caught not only their habits but their ideas. Margaret, a female animal of more than 200 pounds weight, was couched in the basket of a travail, such as I have before described. Besides her ponderous bulk, various domestic utensils were attached to the vehicle, and she was leading by a trail rope a pack horse, who carried the covering of Reno's lodge. Delorier walked briskly by the side of the cart, and Raymond came behind, swearing at the spare horses which it was his business to drive. The restless young Indians, their quivers at their backs and their bows in their hands, galloped over the hills, often starting a wolf or an antelope from the thick growth of wild sage bushes. Shaw and I were in keeping with the rest of the rude cavalcade, having in the absence of other clothing adopted the buckskin attire of the trappers. Henry Chatillon rode in advance of the whole. Thus we passed hill after hill and hollow after hollow, a country arid, broken, and so parched by the sun that none of the plants familiar to our more favored soil would flourish upon it, Though there were multitudes of strange medicinal herbs, more especially the absinthe, which covered every declivity, and cacti were hanging like reptiles at the edges of every ravine. At length we ascended a high hill, our horses treading upon pebbles of flint, agate, and rough jasper, until, gaining the top, we looked down on the wild bottoms of Laramie Creek, which far below us wound like the writhing snake from side to side of the narrow interval, amid a growth of shattered cottonwood and ash trees. Lines of tall cliffs, white as chalk, shut in this green strip of woods and meadowland, into which we descended and encamped for the night. In the morning we passed a wide grassy plain by the river. There was a grove in front, and beneath its shadows the ruins of an old trading fort of logs. The grove bloomed with myriads of wild roses, with their sweet perfume fraught with recollections of home. As we emerged from the trees, a rattlesnake, as large as a man's arm, and more than 4 feet long, lay coiled in a rock, fiercely rattling and hissing at us. A great hare, double the size of those of New England, leaped up from the tall ferns, curlew were screaming over our heads, and a whole host of little prairie dogs sat yelping at us at the mouths of their burrows in the dry plain beyond. Suddenly an antelope leaped up from the wild sage bushes, gazed eagerly at us, and then erecting his white tail, stretched away like a greyhound. The two Indian boys found a white wolf, as large as a calf, in a hollow, and giving a sharp yell, they galloped after him, but the wolf leaped into the stream and swam across. Then came the crack of a rifle, the bullet whistling harmlessly over his head, as he scrambled up the steep declivity, rattling down stones and earth into the water below. Advancing a little, we beheld, in the farther bank of the stream, a spectacle not common even in that region, for, emerging from among point the trees, a herd of some 200 elk came out upon the meadow, their antlers clattering, as they walked forward in a dense throng. Seeing us, they broke into a run, rushing across the opening and disappearing among the trees and scattered groves. In our left was a barren prairie, stretching to the horizon. In our right, a deep gulf, with Laramie Creek at the bottom. We found ourselves at length at the edge of a steep descent, a narrow valley, with long rank grass and scattered trees stretching before us for a mile or more along the course of the stream. Reaching the farther end, we stopped and encamped. An old huge cottonwood tree spread its branches horizontally over our tent. Laramie Creek, circling before our camp, half enclosed us. It swept along the bottom of a line of tall white cliffs that looked down on us from the farther bank. There were dense copses in our right. The cliffs, too, were half hidden by shrubbery, though behind us a few cottonwood trees, topping the green prairie, alone impeded the view, and friend or enemy could be discerned in that direction at a mile's distance. Here we resolved to remain and await the arrival of the whirlwind, who would certainly pass this way in his progress toward La Bonte's camp. To go in search of him was not expedient, both on account of the broken and impracticable nature of the country and the uncertainty of his position and movements. Besides, our horses were almost worn out, and I was in no condition to travel. We had good grass, good water, tolerable fish from the stream, and plenty of smaller game, such as antelope and deer, though no buffalo. There was one little drawback to our satisfaction, a certain extensive tract of bushes and dried grass, just behind us, which it was by no means advisable to enter, since it sheltered a numerous brood of rattlesnakes. Henry Chatillon again dispatched the horse to the village, with a message to Hesco that she and her relatives should leave the rest and push on as rapidly as possible to our camp. Our daily routine soon became as regular as that of a well-ordered household. The weather-beaten old tree was in the center, our rifles generally rested against its vast trunk, and our saddles were flung on the ground around it. Its distorted roots were so twisted as to form one or two convenient armchairs, where we could sit in the shade and read or smoke, but meal times became, in the whole, the most interesting hours of the day, and a bountiful provision was made for them. An antelope or a deer usually swung from a stout bough, and haunches were suspended against the trunk. That camp is to be typed on my memory, the old tree, the white tent, which was sleeping in the shadow of it, and Reynolds' miserable lodge close by the bank of the stream. It was a wretched, oven-shaped structure, made of begrimed and tattered buffalo hides stretched over a frame of poles. One side was open, and at the side of the opening hung the powder horn and bullet pouch of the owner, together with his long red pipe, and a rich quiver of otter skin, with a bow and arrows, for Reynold, an Indian in most things but color, chose to hunt buffalo with these primitive weapons. In the darkness of this cavern-like habitation, might be discerned Madame Marchgott, her overgrown book stowed away among her domestic implements, furs, robes, blankets, and painted cases of poor flesh, in which dried meat is kept. Here she sat from sunrise to sunset, a bloated impersonation of gluttony and laziness, while her affectionate proprietor was smoking, or begging petty gifts from us, or telling lies concerning his own achievements, or perchance engaged in the more profitable occupation of cooking some preparation of prairie delicacies. Reynold was an adept at this work. He and Delorier have joined forces, and are hard at work together over the fire, while Raymond spreads, by way of tablecloth, a buffalo hide carefully whitened with pipe clay, in the grass before the tent. Here, with ostentatious display, he arranges the teacups and plates, and then, creeping on all fours, like a dog, he thrusts his head in at the opening of the tent. For a moment we see his round owlish eyes rolling wildly, as if the idea he came to communicate had suddenly escaped him, then collecting his scattered thoughts, as if by an effort, he informs us that supper is ready, and instantly withdraws. When sunset came, and at that hour the wild and desolate scene would assume a new aspect, the horses were driven in. They had been grazing all day in the neighboring meadow, but now they were picketed close about the camp. As the prairie darkened, we sat and conversed around the fire, until becoming drowsy we spread our saddles in the ground, wrapped our blankets around us and lay down. We never placed a guard, having by this time become too indolent, but Henry Chitillon folded his loaded rifle in the same blanket with himself, observing that he always took it to bed with him, when he camped in that place. Henry was too bold a man to use such a precaution without good cause. We had a hint now and then that our situation was none of the safest. Several Crow war parties were known to be in the vicinity, and one of them, that passed here some time before, had peeled the bark from a neighboring tree, and engraved upon the white wood certain hieroglyphics, to signify that they had invaded the territories of their enemies, the Dakotai, and set them at defiance. One morning a thick mist covered the whole country. Shaw and Henry went out to ride, and soon came back with a startling piece of intelligence. They had found within rifle shot on our camp the recent trail of about 30 horsemen. They could not be whites, and they could not be Dakotai, since we knew no such parties to be in the neighborhood, therefore they must be Crows. Thanks to that friendly mist, we had escaped a hard battle. They would inevitably have attacked us, and our Indian companions had they seen our camp. Whatever doubts we might have entertained were quite removed a day or two after by two or three Dacotai, who came to us with an account of having hidden in a ravine in that very morning, from whence they saw and counted the crows. They said that they followed them, carefully keeping out of sight, as they passed up Chugwater, that here the crows discovered five dead bodies of Dacotai, placed according to the national custom in trees, and flinging them to the ground, they held their guns against them and blew them to atoms. If our camp were not altogether safe, still it was comfortable enough. At least it was so to Shaw, for I was tormented with illness and vexed by the delay in the accomplishment of my designs. When a respite in my disorder gave me some returning strength, I rode out well armed upon the prairie, or bathed with Shaw in the stream, or waged a petty warfare with the inhabitants of a neighboring prairie dog village. Around our fire at night we employed ourselves in inveighing against the fickleness and inconstancy of Indians, and execrating the whirlwind and all his village. At last the thing grew insufferable. "Tomorrow morning," said I will start for the fort, and see if I can hear any news there. Late that evening, when the fire had sunk low, and all the camp were asleep, a loud cry sounded from the darkness. Henry started up, recognized the voice, replied to it, and our dandy friend, the horse, rode in among us, just returned from his mission to the village. He coolly picketed his mare, without saying a word, sat down by the fire and began to eat, but his imperturbable philosophy was too much for our patience. Where was the village? About 50 miles south of us. It was moving slowly and would not arrive in less than a week, and where was Henry's squaw coming as fast as she could with Madhutatanka, and the rest of her brothers, but she would never reach us, for she was dying, and asking every moment for Henry. Henry's manly face became clouded and downcast. He said that, if we were willing he would go in the morning to find her, at which Shaw offered to accompany him. We saddled our horses at sunrise. Reynold protested vehemently against being left alone, with nobody but the two Canadians and the young Indians, when enemies were in the neighborhood. Disregarding his complaints, we left him, and coming to the mouth of Chugwater, separated, Shaw and Henry turning to the right, up the bank of the stream, while I made for the fort. Taking leave for a while of my friend and the unfortunate squaws, I will relate by way of episode what I saw and did at Fort Laraniai. It was not more than 18 miles distant, and I reached it in 3 hours, a shriveled little figure, wrapped from head to foot in a dingy white Canadian capote, stood in the gateway, holding by a cord of bull's hide a shaggy wild horse, which he had lately caught. His sharp prominent features, and his little keen snake-like eyes, looked out from beneath the shadowy hood of the capote, which was drawn over his head exactly like the cowl of a Capuchin friar. His face was extremely thin and like an old piece of leather, and his mouth spread from ear to ear. Extending his long wiry hand, he welcomed me with something more cordial than the ordinary cold salute of an Indian, for we were excellent friends. He had made an exchange of horses to our mutual advantage, and Paul, thinking himself well treated, had declared everywhere that the white man had a good heart. He was a Dacotai from the Missouri, a reputed son of the half-breed interpreter, Pierre Dorion, so often mentioned in Irving's Astoria. He said that he was going to Richard's trading house to sell his horse to some emigrants, who were encamped there, and asked me to go with him. We forded the stream together, Paul dragging his wild charge behind him. As we passed over the sandy plains beyond, he grew quite communicative. Paul was a cosmopolitan in his way. He had been to the settlements of the whites, and visited in peace and war most of the tribes within the range of 1,000 miles. He spoke a jargon of French and another of English, yet nevertheless he was a thorough Indian, and as he told of the bloody deeds of his own people against their enemies, his little eye would glitter with a fierce luster. He told how the Dakotah exterminated a village of the Hoyas in the upper Missouri, slaughtering men, women, and children, and how an overwhelming force of them cut off 16 of the brave Delawares, who fought like wolves to the last, amid the throng of their enemies. He told me also another story, which I did not believe, until I had heard it confirmed from so many independent sources that no room was left for doubt. I am tempted to introduce it here. 6 years ago, a fellow named Jim Beckwith, a mongrel of French, American, and Negro blood, was trading for the Fur Company, in a very large village of the Crows. Jim Beckwith was last summer at St. Louis. He is a ruffian of the first stamp, bloody and treacherous, without honor or honesty, such at least is the character he bears upon the prairie. Yet in his case all the standard rules of character fail, for, though he will stab a man in his sleep, he will also perform most desperate acts of daring, such for instance as the following. While he was in the Crow Village, a Blackfoot war party, between 30 and 40 in number, came stealing through the country, killing stragglers and carrying off horses. The Crow warriors got upon their trail and pressed them so closely that they could not escape, at which the Blackfeet, throwing up a semicircular breastwork of logs at the foot of a precipice, coolly awaited their approach. The logs and sticks piled 4 or 5 feet high, protected them in front. The Crows might have swept over the breastwork and exterminated their enemies, but though outnumbering them tenfold, they did not dream of storming the little fortification. Such a proceeding would be altogether repugnant to their notions of warfare. Whooping and yelling, and jumping from side to side like devils incarnate, they showered bullets and arrows upon the logs. Not a Blackfoot was hurt, but several Crows, in spite of their leaping and dodging, were shot down. In this childish manner, the fight went on, for an hour or two. Now and then a Crow warrior, in an ecstasy of valor and vainglory, would scream forth his war song, boasting himself the bravest and greatest of mankind, and grasping his hatchet, would rush up and strike it upon the breastwork, and then, as he retreated to his companions, fall dead under a shower of arrows. Yet no combined attack seemed to be dreamed of. The Blackfeet remained secure in their entrenchment. At last Jim Beckwith lost patience. "Ah, you are all fools and old women," he said to the Crows. "Come with me, if any of you are brave enough, and I will show you how to fight." He threw off his trapper's frock of buckskin and stripped himself naked like the Indians themselves. He left his rifle in the ground, and taking in his hand a small light hatchet, he ran over the prairie to the right, concealed by a hollow from the eyes of the Blackfeet. Then climbing up the rocks, he gained the top of the precipice behind them. 40 or 50 young Crow warriors followed him. By the cries and hoops that rose from below he knew that the Blackfeet were just beneath him, and running forward he leaped down the rock into the midst of them. As he fell he caught one by the long loose hair, and dragging him down tomahawked him, then grasping another by the belt at his waist, he struck him also a stunning blow, and gaining his feet, shouted the Crow war cry. He swung his hatchet so fiercely around him, that the astonished Blackfeet bore back and gave him room. he might, had he chosen, have leaped over the breastwork and escaped, but this was not necessary, for with devilish yells the Crow warriors came dropping in quick succession over the rock among their enemies. The main body of the Crows, too, answered the cry from the front, and rushed up simultaneously. The convulsive struggle within the breastwork was frightful. For an instant the Blackfeet fought and yelled like pent-up tigers, but the butchery was soon complete, and the mangled bodies lay piled up together under the precipice. Not a Blackfoot made his escape. As Paul finished his story, we came in sight of Richard's fort. It stood in the middle of the plain, a disorderly crowd of men around it, and an emigrant camp a little in front. "Now, Paul," said I, "where are your Minneconjou lodges?"
"Not he come yet," said Paul, "maybe come tomorrow."
Two large villages of a band of Dakotai had come 300 miles from the Missouri to join in the war, and they were expected to reach Richards that morning. There was, as yet, no sign of their approach, so pushing through a noisy, drunken crowd, I entered an apartment of logs and mud, the largest in the fort. It was full of men of various races and complexions, all more or less drunk. A company of California immigrants, it seemed, had made the discovery at this late day that they had encumbered themselves with too many supplies for their journey. A part, therefore, they had thrown away or sold at great loss to the traders, but had determined to get rid of their very copious stock of Missouri whiskey by drinking it on the spot. Here were maudlin squaws stretched on piles of buffalo robes, squalid Mexicans, armed with bows and arrows, Indians sedately drunk, long-haired Canadians and trappers, and American backwoodsmen in brown homespun, the well-beloved pistol and bowie knife displayed openly at their sides. In the middle of the room a tall, lank man, with a dingy broadcloth coat, was haranguing the company in the style of the stump orator. With one hand he sawed the air, and with the other clutched firmly a brown jug of whiskey, which he applied every moment to his lips, forgetting that he had drained the contents long ago. Richard formally introduced me to this personage, who was no less a man than Colonel R__, once the leader of the party. Instantly the Colonel, seizing me, in the absence of buttons, by the leather fringes of my frock, began to define his position. His men, he said, had mutinied and deposed him, but still he exercised over them the influence of a superior mind, in all but a name he was yet their chief. As the Colonel spoke, I looked round in the wild assemblage, and could not help thinking that he was but ill qualified to conduct such men across the deserts to California. Conspicuous among the rest stood three tall young men, grandsons of Daniel Boone. They had clearly inherited the adventurous character of that prince of pioneers, but I saw no signs of the quiet and tranquil spirit that so remarkably distinguished him. Fearful was the fate that months after overtook some of the members of that party. General Kearney, in his late return from California, brought in the account how they were interrupted by the deep snows among the mountains, and maddened by cold and hunger, fed upon each other's flesh. I got tired of the confusion. "Come, Paul," said I, "we will be off." Paul sat in the sun, under the wall of the fort. He jumped up, mounted, and we rode toward Fort Laramie. When we reached it, a man came out of the gate with a pack at his back and a rifle in his shoulder. Others were gathering about him, shaking him by the hand, as if taking leave. I thought it a strange thing that a man should set out alone and in foot for the prairie. I soon got an explanation. Peraltis, if I recollect right,
was the Canadian's name had quarreled with the bourgeois, and the fort was too hot to hold him. Bordeaux, inflated with Estrancian authority, had abused him, and received a blow in return. The men then sprang on each other, and grappled in the middle of the fort. Bordeaux was down in an instant, at the mercy of the incensed Canadian, had not an old Indian, the brother of Chasquot, seized hold of his antagonist, he would have fared ill. Perrault broke loose from the old Indian, and both the white men ran to their rooms for their guns, but when Bordeaux, looking from his door, saw the Canadian, gun in hand, standing in the area and calling on him to come out and fight, his heart failed him, he chose to remain where he was. In vain the old Indian, scandalized by his brother-in-law's cowardice, called upon him to go upon the prairie and fight it out in the white man's manner, and Bordeaux's own squaw, equally incensed, screamed to her lord and master that he was a dog and an old woman. It all availed nothing. Bordeaux's prudence got the better of his valor, and he would not stir. Perrault stood showering opprobrious epithets at the recreant bourgeois. Growing tired of this, he made up a pack of dried meat, and slinging it at his back, set out alone for Fort Pierre, in the Missouri, a distance of 300 miles, over a desert country, full of hostile Indians. I remained in the fort that night. In the morning, as I was coming out from breakfast, conversing with a trader named McCluskey, I saw a strange Indian leaning against the side of the gate. He was a tall, strong man, with heavy features. Who is he? I asked. That's the whirlwind, said McCluskey. He is the fellow that made all this stir about the war. It's always the way with the Sioux. They never stop cutting each other's throats. It's all they are fit for, instead of sitting in their lodges and getting robes to trade with us in the winter. If this war goes on, we'll make a poor trade of it next season, I reckon. And this was the opinion of all the traders, who were vehemently opposed to the war, from the serious injury that it must occasion to their interests. The whirlwind left his village the day before to make a visit to the fort. His warlike ardor had abated not a little, since he first conceived the design of avenging his son's death. The long and complicated preparations for the expedition were too much for his fickle, inconstant disposition. That morning Bordeaux fastened upon him, made him presents, and told him that, if he went to war he would destroy his horses and kill no buffalo to trade with the white men, in short, that he was a fool to think of such a thing, and had better make up his mind to sit quietly in his lodge and smoke his pipe, like a wise man. The whirlwind's purpose was evidently shaken. He had become tired, like a child, of his favorite plan. Bordeaux exultingly predicted that he would not go to war. My philanthropy at that time was no match for my curiosity, and I was vexed at the possibility that after all I might lose the rare opportunity of seeing the formidable ceremonies of war. The whirlwind, however, had merely thrown the firebrand. The conflagration was become general. All the western bands of the Dakotai were bent on war, and as I heard from McCluskey, 6 large villages were already gathered in a little stream, 40 miles distant, and were daily calling to the Great Spirit to aid them in their enterprise. McCluskey had just left them, and represented them, as on their way to La Bonte's camp, which they would reach in a week, unless they should learn that there were no buffalo there. I did not like this condition, for buffalo this season were rare in the neighborhood. There were also the 2 Minneconja villages that I mentioned before, but about noon, an Indian came from Richard's fort with the news that they were quarreling, breaking up, and dispersing. So much for the whiskey of the emigrants. Finding themselves unable to drink the whole, they had sold the residue to these Indians, and it needed no prophet to foretell the result. A spark dropped into a powder magazine would not have produced a quicker effect. Instantly the old jealousies and rivalries and smothered feuds that exist in an Indian village broke out into furious quarrels. They forgot the warlike enterprise that had already brought them 300 miles. They seemed like ungoverned children inflamed with the fiercest passions of men. Several of them were stabbed in the drunken tumult, and in the morning they scattered and moved back toward the Missouri in small parties. I feared that, after all, the long-projected meeting and the ceremonies that were to attend it might never take place, and I should lose so admirable an opportunity of seeing the Indian under his most fearful and characteristic aspect. However, in foregoing this, I should avoid a very fair probability of being plundered and stripped, and it might be stabbed or shot into the bargain. Consoling myself with this reflection, I prepared to carry the news, such as it was, to the camp. I caught my horse, and to my vexation found he had lost a shoe and broken his tender white hoof against the rocks. Horses are shod at Fort Laramie at the moderate rate of $3 a foot, so I tied Hendrick to a beam in the corral, and summoned Ruby Dow, the blacksmith. Ruby Dow, with the hoof between his knees, was at work with hammer and file, and I was inspecting the process, when a strange voice addressed me. "To Morgan Under. Well, there is more of us left yet. Here's Jean Grass and me off to the mountains tomorrow. Our turn will come next, I suppose. It's a hard life, anyhow." I looked up and saw a little man, not much more than 5 feet high, but of very square and strong proportions. In appearance he was particularly dingy, for his old buckskin frock was black and polished with time and grease, and his belt, knife, pouch and powder horn appeared to have seen the roughest service. The first joint of each foot was entirely gone, having been frozen off several winters before, and his moccasins were curtailed in proportion. His whole appearance and equipment bespoke the free trapper. He had a round, ruddy face, animated with a spirit of carelessness and gaiety not at all in accordance with the words he had just spoken. "To Morgan," said I, "what do you mean by that?" "Oh," said he, "the Arapahoes have just killed two of us in the mountains. Old Bull Tail has come to tell us. They stabbed one behind his back, and shot the other with his own rifle. That's the way we live here. I mean to give up trapping after this year. My squaw says she wants a pacing horse and some red ribbons. I'll make enough beaver to get them for her, and then I'm done. I'll go below and live on a farm. Your bones will dry on the prairie," Rallo said, another trapper, who was standing by, a strong, brutal-looking fellow, with a face as surly as a bulldog's. Rallo only laughed, and began to hum a tune and shuffle a dance in his stumps of feet. "You'll see us, before long, passing up your way," said the other man. "Well," said I, "stop and take a cup of coffee with us," and as it was quite late in the afternoon, I prepared to leave the fort at once. As I rode out, a train of emigrant wagons was passing across the stream. "Where are ye going, stranger?" Thus I was saluted by two or three voices at once. "About 18 miles up the creek. It's mighty late to be going that far. Make haste, you'd better, and keep a bright lookout for Indians." I thought the advice too good to be neglected. Fording the stream, I passed at a round trot over the plains beyond. But the more haste, the worse speed. I proved the truth of the proverb by the time I reached the hills 3 miles from the fort. The trail was faintly marked, and riding forward with more rapidity than caution, I lost sight of it. I kept on in a direct line guided by Laramie Creek, which I could see at intervals darkly glistening in the evening sun, at the bottom of the Woody Gulf in my right. Half an hour before sunset I came upon its banks. There was something exciting in the wild solitude of the place. An antelope sprang suddenly from the sage bushes before me. As he leaped gracefully not 30 yards before my horse, I fired, and instantly he spun round and fell. Quite sure of him, I walked my horse toward him, leisurely reloading my rifle, when to my surprise he sprang up and trotted rapidly away in 3 legs into the dark recesses of the hills, whither I had no time to follow. 10 minutes after, I was passing along the bottom of a deep valley, and chancing to look behind me, I saw in the dim light that something was following. Supposing it to be a wolf, I slid from my seat and sat down behind my horse to shoot it, but as it came up, I saw by its motions that it was another antelope. It approached within 100 yards, arched its graceful neck, and gazed intently. I leveled at the white spot in its chest, and was about to fire, when it started off, ran first to one side and then to the other, like a vessel tacking against a wind, and at last stretched away at full speed. Then it stopped again, looked curiously behind it, and trotted up as before, but not so boldly, for it soon paused and stood gazing at me. I fired, it leaped upward and fell upon its tracks. Measuring the distance, I found it 204 paces. When I stood by his side, the antelope turned his expiring eye upward. It was like a beautiful woman's, dark and rich. Fortunate that I am in a hurry, thought I might be troubled with remorse, if I had time for it. Cutting the animal up, not in the most skillful manner, I hung the meat at the back of my saddle, and rode in again. The hills, I could not remember one of them, closed around me. It is too late, thought I, to go forward. I will stay here tonight, and look for the path in the morning. As a last effort, however, I ascended a high hill, from which, to my great satisfaction, I could see Laramie Creek stretching before me, twisting from side to side amid ragged patches of timber, and far off, close beneath the shadows of the trees, the ruins of the old trading fort were visible. I reached them at twilight. It was far from pleasant, in that uncertain light, to be pushing through the dense trees and shrubbery of the grove beyond. I listened anxiously for the footfall of man or beast. Nothing was stirring but one harmless brown bird, chirping among the branches. I was glad, when I gained the open prairie once more, where I could see, if anything approached. When I came to the mouth of Jugwater, it was totally dark. Slackening the reins, I let my horse take his own course. He trotted in with an erring instinct, and by 9 o'clock was scrambling down the steep descent into the meadows, where we were encamped. While I was looking in vain for the light of the fire, Hendrick, with keener perceptions, gave a loud neigh, which was immediately answered in a shrill note from the distance. In a moment I was hailed from the darkness by the voice of Reynold, who had come out, rifle in hand, to see who was approaching. He, with his squaws, the 2 Canadians and the Indian boys, were the sole inmates of the camp, Shaw and Henry Chatillon being still absent. At noon of the following day they came back, their horses looking none the better for the journey. Henry seemed dejected. The woman was dead, and his children must henceforward be exposed, without a protector, to the hardships and vicissitudes of Indian life. Even in the midst of his griefs he had not forgotten his attachment to his bourgeois, for he had procured among his Indian relatives two beautifully ornamented buffalo robes, which he spread in the ground as a present to us. Shaw lighted his pipe, and told me in a few words the history of his journey. When I went to the fort they left me, as I mentioned, at the mouth of Jugwater. They followed the course of the little stream all day, traversing a desolate and barren country. Several times they came upon the fresh traces of a large war party, the same, no doubt, from whom we had so narrowly escaped an attack. At an hour before sunset, without encountering a human being by the way, they came upon the lodges of the squaw and her brothers, who in compliance with Henry's message, had left the Indian village, in order to join us at our camp. The lodges were already pitched, five in number, by the side of the stream. The woman lay in one of them, reduced to a mere skeleton. For some time she had been unable to move or speak. Indeed, nothing had kept her alive but the hope of seeing Henry, to whom she was strongly and faithfully attached. No sooner did he enter the lodge than she revived and conversed with him the greater part of the night. Early in the morning she was lifted into a travail, and the whole party set out toward our camp. There were but five warriors, the rest were women and children. The whole were in great alarm at the proximity of the Crow war party, who would certainly have destroyed them without mercy had they met. They had advanced only a mile or two, when they discerned a horseman, far off, in the edge of the horizon. They all stopped, gathering together in the greatest anxiety, from which they did not recover until long, after the horseman disappeared, then they set out again. Henry was riding with Shaw a few rods in advance of the Indians, when Manotonka, a younger brother of the woman, hastily called after them. Turning back, they found all the Indians crowded around the travail in which the woman was lying. They reached her just in time to hear the death rattle in her throat. In a moment she lay dead in the basket of the vehicle. A complete stillness succeeded, then the Indians raised in concert their cries of lamentation over the corpse, and among them Shaw clearly distinguished those strange sounds resembling the word Hallelujah, which together with some other accidental coincidences, has given rise to the absurd theory that the Indians are descended from the 10 lost tribes of Israel. The Indian usage required that Henry, as well as the other relatives of the woman, should make valuable presents, to be placed by the side of the body at its last resting place. Leaving the Indians, he and Shaw set out for the camp and reached it, as we have seen, by hard pushing, at about noon. Having obtained the necessary articles, they immediately returned. It was very late and quite dark when they again reached the lodges. They were all placed in a deep hollow among the dreary hills. Four of them were just visible through the gloom, but the fifth and largest was illuminated by the ruddy blaze of a fire within, glowing through the half-transparent covering of raw hides. There was a perfect stillness as they approached. The lodges seemed without a tenant. Not a living thing was stirring. There was something awful in the scene. They rode up to the entrance of the lodge, and there was no sound but the tramp of their horses. A squaw came out and took charge of the animals, without speaking a word. Entering, they found the lodge crowded with Indians, a fire was burning in the midst, and the mourners encircled it in a triple row. Room was made for the newcomers at the head of the lodge, a robe spread for them to sit upon, and a pipe lighted and handed to them in perfect silence. Thus they passed the greater part of the night. At times the fire would subside into a heap of embers, until the dark figures seated around it were scarcely visible, Then a squaw would drop upon it a piece of buffalo fat, and a bright flame instantly springing up, would reveal on a sudden the crowd of wild faces, motionless as bronze. The silence continued unbroken. It was a relief to Shaw when daylight returned and he could escape from this house of mourning. He and Henry prepared to return homeward. First, however, they placed the presents they had brought near the body of the squaw, which, most gaudily attired, remained in a sitting posture in one of the lodges. A fine horse was picketed not far off, destined to be killed that morning for the service of her spirit, for the woman was lame, and could not travel on foot over the dismal prairies to the villages of the dead. Food, too, was provided, and household implements, for her use upon this last journey. Henry left her to the care of her relatives, and came immediately with Shaw to the camp. It was some time before he entirely recovered from his dejection.